From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is a special edition of Radio Boston, live from downtown Manchester, New Hampshire. Just before the nation's first primary, we'll hear from our political reporters, New Hampshire voters.
I'm undecided. I live in Dover, New Hampshire. We've seen Pete, we've seen Biden, we've seen Bernie, today Warren, and tonight we're going to see Amy. And I'm still trying to decide.
I was thinking again, who's going to beat Trump, and it was Biden. But just seeing the way it's like a balloon kind of leaking air.
You got to vote for Trump. Remember that. Tell everybody, vote for Trump.
It was very clear Elizabeth Warren was my choice.
We've also got historians and keen New Hampshire political watchers. And as always, you at 1-800-423-8255. It is a special hour of Radio Boston, live from Manchester, New Hampshire.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston, and I'm Tiziana Deering. We are broadcasting live today from WBUR studio overlooking downtown Manchester, New Hampshire. One day to go now until voters here in the Granite State vote in the first in the nation primary. On the Democratic side, 11 candidates are crisscrossing the state. And on the Republican side, former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld is challenging President Trump for the party's nomination. The Radio Boston team has also been all over New Hampshire talking to voters.
My name's Stan McDonald and my wife, Kim.
Hi.
We live in Bedford. Who do we like? Amy Klobuchar. She seems like somebody that could bring both parties together.
Frank Twardowski. I'm 80 years old and gone. We got to vote for Trump. Remember that. Tell everybody, vote for Trump. We don't have no more common sense in this country. We're in deep doo-doo, okay?
Dave Whitehead, Windham. I can't vote for Pete because I'm a Republican, so I'm voting for anybody but Donald Trump.
John Jackson, Portsmouth. I'm not particularly excited about any of them, so maybe Pete, maybe Yang, Donald Duck maybe, I don't know.
The whole range of emotions there from around New Hampshire. This hour on Radio Boston, we are on the ground in the Granite State. We'll check in with reporters and analysts, and we'll talk about what the New Hampshire primary is telling us about the state of American politics. If you are in New Hampshire, we want to hear from you. And if you're watching with interest from Massachusetts, call us. Join the conversation. Who are you supporting? Is this election different from 2016? Are you yearning for disruption or a return to political normalcy? Give us a call. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So let's start with WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. He's joining us live from outside Peterborough, New Hampshire. Hey there, Anthony.
Hey, Tiziana.
Hey, so what's going on and where are you headed, Anthony?
So where have I been? Last night I was at a Bernie Sanders rally in Keene, New Hampshire. It was one of the biggest events of the campaign so far, about 2,000 people there. This morning, Amy Klobuchar in Keene, who's enjoying a little bit of a surge, and I'm on my way to a Pete Buttigieg event later this afternoon in Milford. Let's start with that Amy Klobuchar rally, which is sort of interesting because the latest polls, Tiziana, show her moving up to third place after that strong debate Friday night. So she's enjoying a little bit of a surge. And when you speak to voters, you're talking to people who it's not that they dislike Sanders, but they're looking for someone who is more moderate. Maybe it's Buttigieg, maybe it's Klobuchar. So I spoke with voter Alan Mendelson, a Democrat from Keene. Here's what he said this morning.
I was thinking again, who's going to beat Trump? And it was Biden. But just seeing the way it's like a balloon kind of leaking air. So Amy has the experience. She's from the Midwest. You know, she's solid. And I think that's what people will need.
And Tiziana, that was certainly Klobuchar's message this morning in Keene. She sort of casts herself as that reasonable progressive from the Midwest who wins in red counties and offering a sort of big tent kind of pragmatism to Democrats. And here's a little bit of what she said about winning and having a record of winning.
I have won every race
I've ever run back to fourth grade. Because, I mean, all these guys are always boasting about things, so that's my thing. And back then I had a slogan, all the way with Amy Kay, which I have since abandoned. I don't think it's the best one, but that was it back then.
So that's Amy Klobuchar speaking this morning in Keene, New Hampshire.
Yeah, and you said you've also been following Bernie Sanders. He, with Pete Buttigieg, came out on top in this kind of confusing Iowa caucus. How is Sanders doing as a potential frontrunner on the trail?
Well, I think it's pretty fair to say that he's the frontrunner, at least according to the polls. And he's certainly got a lot of passion on the ground. And honestly, he's benefiting from the sort of fragmentation of the not Bernie vote, if you see what I mean. I mean, there's Klobuchar, there's Biden, there's Elizabeth Warren, there's kind of this jostling and Buttigieg, of course, there's sort of this jostling for second, third and fourth place behind Sanders. So for people who are uncomfortable with Sanders' hard left progressive agenda, that vote is splintered. It's a little bit like the Donald Trump vote back in 2016. I mean, Trump was able to benefit as he rolled toward the nomination process by so many candidates in the race splintering the not Donald Trump vote. And so Bernie Sanders only has core supporters, he also benefits from that splintering.
Well, and he did win New Hampshire last time around, state next door for him. He's polling at the top. Does that mean that anything other than a win for him is really a loss here in New Hampshire?
I mean, I don't know. You know, he's got so much money and so much organization that I think it would be quite surprising if he didn't win. But I don't know if I would characterize it as a loss. I think we would all be incredibly surprised. And then, of course, we'd be talking about who did win. Would that be Buttigieg? And that would be quite a thing for him. But, you know, last night in Keene, Bernie Sanders talked about the need to have more voters come out tomorrow than ever before in the history of New Hampshire primaries. That's his goal. He wants to expand the electorate by getting all kinds of people who don't usually vote. Now, that didn't work out the way he wanted it in Iowa, although, as he points out, the youth vote was quite high in Iowa. But his calculus that he can win and roll across the country winning by expanding the electorate hasn't been borne out completely yet on the terms that he's laid out.
So I want to shift gears to Joe Biden. Tomorrow seems like it must be pretty important for him, Anthony. He had a disappointing finish in Iowa, not looking good in the polls here in New Hampshire. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, Joe Biden is in a bind. His argument all along is that he's the most electable, that he can beat Donald Trump. But if you don't prove that you can actually win, that argument begins to sort of lose some of its credibility. He had a very disappointing result in Iowa, as you pointed out. He admitted as much in the debate that he doesn't think he's going to have a great result in New Hampshire. He's hoping for that firewall down in South Carolina, where he has the support of a lot of African-American voters who make up the biggest chunk of the Democratic electorate down there. I'm looking right now at the Real Clear Politics average, and in South Carolina, Biden is ahead with 31% of the vote. Sanders has about 17%, Elizabeth Warren less than 10%. So
I'm going to interrupt you
there,
Anthony. I'd like to pick up on Elizabeth Warren, actually. We've got limited time, and I know you had a chance to speak with Elizabeth Warren. I'd like to have you tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. So I spoke to her Saturday night, and we sort of talked about the state of her campaign. And I began by asking her about her ground operation and whether it is enough to get her beyond a third place finish here in New Hampshire.
I just see this as a chance to pull more people into this fight. You know, fighting for working families, trying to figure out why America's middle class has been hollowed out and how we change that. This has been my life's work. And now, running for president, I get a chance to get out there and really lay out plans for how we could fix it.
I want to ask you about, it seems like, even post-Iowa, that the results of this race so far are still muddled. The party is still divided between progressives and sort of centrists. How do you become the unity candidate to sort of bring these two groups together?
So I think I'm the best person to beat Donald Trump because I think I'm the best person to bring our party together. You know, I built a very inclusive campaign, a campaign that's very open. We started this whole primary process with, what, 25 or so people in it. As a lot of those folks have had to end their campaigns, we've brought in a lot of their staffers, their volunteers, and they bring new energy and more ideas into it and more commitment. I think that's what we got to do as Democrats. We can't repeat 2016 with two parts of the party just firing on each other. And a second part of that, I think, is what we run on. You know, the things I talk about corruption, about why government works so well for those at the top and the influence of money, that's something all Democrats can get behind. And it means Democrats up and down the ticket can run on it. It also pulls in a lot of independents and Republicans. That 2-cent wealth tax that I've been fighting for, that's something that's popular among Democrats and Republicans. I think that's how we bring our party together, and that's how we beat Donald Trump in November.
Well, so far in this campaign that you've run, what surprised you?
It's how personal politics is for so many people. I do town halls. The fact that I decided that I wasn't going to spend 70% of my time raising money from billionaires and corporate executives and lobbyists means I had a lot more time to do town halls and take questions. But one of the best parts is after the town hall's over, I stay and do selfie lines. And the number of people who come and say, glad to see you, this is great, but then say, I'm getting crushed by student loan debt. Without child care, I can't go back to work. I had a woman, adorable little girl, with her. We did our pinky promises, and the little girl danced all around, and as she was dancing off stage, the mother gave me a hug and whispered in my ear to please take care of health care because her daughter had brain cancer. You know, it's how much people see up close and personal that the decisions that we make in this 2020 election will touch their lives directly forever.
Anthony, that's just such a reminder.
That Saturday. I just wanted to say, Tiziana, coming out of that, of course, there's a lot riding on tomorrow's result for Elizabeth Warren, who badly needs to improve what she did in Iowa.
And what are voters telling you, Anthony, these last 30 seconds are most important to them now that the vote is coming tomorrow?
Well, in 30 seconds, I mean, what you hear again and again and again is finding a candidate, settling on a candidate who can beat Donald Trump. And I think that's one of the things that's tying Democrats in knots who aren't for Bernie Sanders. They're trying to figure out who is the candidate who can best beat Donald Trump.
That is WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks, live from Peterborough, New Hampshire. Thanks, Anthony.
You're very welcome.
And we have Radio Boston's Chris Sitterick joining us live from outside the SNHU Arena in downtown Manchester. That's where President Trump is holding a rally tonight. Hey there, Chris.
Hey, Tiziana.
All right, so Chris, capture the mood for us.
Well, I got to tell you, it was raining earlier. It's been cold all day. There's slush all over the streets. It hasn't dampened anybody's spirits out here. This crowd has been pretty raucous, pretty happy. Lots of smiles, people cheering when a video of Trump flashes up on the giant video screen out here. They've been playing loud music pretty much all day. And I talked to a lot of folks earlier this morning who got here around 8 a.m. And basically were just totally content to stand outside to make sure that they got inside to see the president, but also to show their support for his first term. One of those folks, Steve Ostravis, is a self-identified senior citizen from Pelham, New Hampshire, says basically he got exactly what he wanted from Trump when he voted for him in 2016 and can't wait to vote for him again.
He's kept all his promises. Or he's done his best. Some of the promises he couldn't because some Democrats are putting roadblocks in front of him, but he's doing a great job. I don't think anyone else in the world could do as good a job as he could.
Now, this is a crowd obviously outside a Trump rally. It's a very Trump-friendly crowd, but I got to tell you, the passion for their candidate is palpable. And combine that with all the hats and T-shirts and flags and Trump mailboxes. I mean, every piece of merch you could imagine is being sold out here. It is an interesting scene.
All right, so a lot of strong support within the party, but the president is being challenged by former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld. What are Trump's supporters saying about Weld's challenge?
Funny you should ask that. Short answer, not a lot. I asked at least a dozen people about Bill Weld's primary challenge. Most of what I got from folks sounded something like this.
I don't know much about Bill Weld, so I don't...
I have no idea who that is.
I know who he is. He's a non-player.
About who?
Bill Weld. He's a former Massachusetts governor.
I'm going to tell you, I know nothing about Massachusetts politics. He must be a nobody, because I never heard of him.
So that was Dan LeClaire of Swansea, New Hampshire, Elizabeth Moreau of Manchester, Richard Burns of Derry, and Alan Hofston from St. Louis. Alan is actually one of the vendors selling Trump merchandise. He follows these rallies around the country doing so. I did talk to one voter who had at least somewhat positive feelings towards Weld. Nancy Kindler, 71, of Epping, New Hampshire, said basically she hears that Bill Weld is a lovely guy, but that Trump is, quote, our salty sailor sent by God, and let me tell you, this country's better off for it.
All right, now, is Trump's appearance here also an attempt to take the wind out of the Democrats' sails tomorrow, Chris?
It's kind of hard to read it as anything else, right? I mean, he's got a primary challenger, but Bill Weld has never really broken that 10% mark in any of the polls. He's really been between 5 and 10 the whole race. So it's not a serious primary challenge. Trump did well in New Hampshire in 2016. He lost by a tiny margin to Hillary Clinton, but it's not as if he's building anything from scratch here. So other than the eyes of the country are on New Hampshire, and that's where Trump wants to be, it's hard to explain why the rally would be here otherwise.
Okay, Chris, and take just a minute to share some of the key issues for the president's supporters as they're standing in line there today.
I mean, there's no doubt about the big one. It's the economy. Pretty much everybody I talked to said that the economy being strong was a huge factor in their vote. And one voter really kind of brought that home for me, so to speak. Elizabeth Moreau, 33 years old from Manchester, said it's really all about what President Trump can do for her family.
My children are important. He's been pushing for school choice, which is big here in New Hampshire. Charter schools, getting us funding for that. My retirement account's been going up. My home value's been going up. Does he make mistakes? Does he say stupid stuff sometimes? Of course he does. But overall, his policies have been nothing but good for my family.
And I just found that really striking, especially when you put it in the context of everything we've heard during the impeachment proceedings, talking about a phone call to the president of Ukraine and withholding military aid, things like that. It feels nebulous compared to some of those on-the-ground issues for these folks.
And Chris, what's your sense? Is there any common ground left, you know, after the impeachment acquittal last week, State of the Union, the president's recent comments?
I mean, you have to kind of hope so, right, for the sake of our country. I have to be honest. I did not get that sense talking to folks out here. Pretty much everyone I talked to used the word socialism, communism, talked about Democrats across the board as being liars, power hungry, corrupt. Pretty hard to cooperate if you see the other side of the aisle that way, right? Give you an example. Jenny Wilson, who's from Puerto Rico originally, now lives in Barrington, New Hampshire. She basically said Democrats have literally nothing to offer the country.
I think that they are running on hate Trump. We have to beat Trump. It's all Trump, 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 Trump. Even though Trump is not on the stage, he is on the stage because they bring him in all the time. And I think that they don't have anything to offer the American people because the American people are very happy with the economy and with all the good things that our president is doing.
I just want to add a little context to that. According to a breakdown of election results from 2016 from the Center for American Progress, 29% of Latino voters voted for Trump in 2016, which is pretty similar to what Mitt Romney received in 2012. Also worth noting that more than half of Latino voters stayed home in 2016. But so far, as of November at least, a poll by Telemundo found that Latino voters, who will for the first time be the largest minority group voting in this election, they're about 25% support, so pretty steady for President Trump.
All right, that's Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. It's outside the SNHU Arena, where President Trump is going to hold a rally tonight. Chris, thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to turn momentarily to our WBUR reporter, Fred Tice. But before we do, I'd like to get a couple of calls in. Let's hear from you, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jeff, you're on the line from Dover, New Hampshire. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead, Fred. Jeff, thanks.
Yeah, I'm planning on voting for Pete Buttigieg.
Why is that, Jeff?
Pete is more of a moderate. I have a lot of respect for his service to the country as a veteran in the Navy, and we're of similar age, so that's very appealing to me.
And is he the most viable candidate in your mind, Jeff?
I think so. I think that Senators Warren and Sanders, I have a lot of respect for them, but I just think it's too far left, too fast right now for where most Americans are, and Democrats especially, people who might be on the fence between Trump and a Democratic candidate.
All right, that's Jeff from Dover, New Hampshire. Thanks for calling, Jeff. Let's pick up Kyle as well. Kyle's calling from Sterling, Massachusetts. What's on your mind, Kyle?
Hi, thanks for having me. As a young voter in the small town of Sterling, Massachusetts, I absolutely support Donald Trump. I will be voting for him. I'm actually on my way to the Manchester rally right now. I support him because of his the economic goals that he's reached. He's reduced minority unemployment as well as unemployment in general. It's the lowest it's been since probably before I was alive. I also don't really think that I don't really plan on voting for candidates like Elizabeth Warren, even though I am a Massachusetts resident, just because I was kind of disappointed that she said when she was campaigning against Jeff Deal, she said, Jeff Deal was saying how she, was going to run for president after this. That was her goal and stuff. And she actually proved him right. And so I'm kind of disappointed as a Massachusetts voter.
All right. Thanks for that call, Kyle. That was the Senate race I know that you were talking about. You probably got to hit the road. It sounds like there's a long line up here for the rally. So head on up and get in line. Thanks for that call. Let's turn now to WBUR's Fred Tice. He's on the trail with Senator Elizabeth Warren. She's just wrapping up a rally in Rochester, New Hampshire. Hey there, Fred.
Hey, Tiziana. Yes, as you said, Warren is still addressing folks here at a packed Rochester Opera House. Several hundred people packed in here to listen to her as she is wrapping up her rally.
I'm hearing a lot of happiness, a lot of cheers there, Fred. What is the mood among Warren's supporters today?
The mood is, on the one hand, quite ebullient, but on the other, there's some concern. I'll give you an example. I was talking to a volunteer for Warren in here earlier today. He's been knocking on a lot of doors, and he was telling me that a lot of people are still undecided. And they're undecided between Warren and Sanders or Warren and Buttigieg. And so they feel like the volunteers feel like they still have a lot of work trying to win those folks over. On the other hand, there, as I said, there are quite a few people who are still undecided here in this room. I spoke to a voter from Dover. Her name is Wanda Hoffman. Here's what she had to say.
We've made the rounds. We've seen Pete. We've seen Biden. We've seen Bernie today. Warren, and tonight we're going to see Amy. And I'm still trying to decide. They all have something, their different strengths, but who can go against Trump? That's the big question everybody asks.
Indeed, that is the big question. And it is the question that Warren is trying to address here. As she sums up her campaign, she's trying to show that she's the fighter who can beat Trump. So today, for example, she talked about how she got in the race against Scott Brown and how she beat him, a popular incumbent. She talked about how Mitch McConnell tried to get her off the Senate floor when she was reading a letter from Coretta Scott King, and an episode that gave rise to the meme, "Nevertheless, she persisted." And she's also talking about the fact that she does not have as much money as some of the other candidates, such as Buttigieg or Sanders, and that is because she does not take money from big donors or from PACs. And she is saying to the audience here today that if the people with the most money are not the ones who are going to win, it's the people with the most persistence who are going to win.
Fred, let's talk about expectations for a minute. What happens with the Warren campaign if she does not do well tomorrow?
Well, there, Warren herself says that she goes on, right? I mean, she's got 1,000 people on her staff across the country. She is in 30 states. Her campaign's already planning for her trip to Nevada after the New Hampshire primary. So this does not stop. She has said that this could be a very long race. Who knows at this point? It could go to a brokered convention. I'm sorry, I'm being told to be a little quiet here because we are still in the Opera House. But anyway, go ahead.
All right, so I'll just ask you one quick last question then. She's been adding to her key themes, some real messages about unity, saying she's the one who can unite the party. How do you think voters are responding to that, Fred?
Say again, Tiziana.
So she's been adding some messages to her stump speech, not just her usual plans and key themes, but now talking about her ability to unite the party and calling for unity. Is that resonating with people out in the trail?
Yeah, it is. You know, I was talking to voters in Lebanon and New Hampshire last night who were saying that this is something that really appeals to them. They see her as the uniter in the race. And so, you know, and these are folks who had seen Sanders, had seen Buttigieg, and yet were landing with Warren.
All right, that is WBUR's Fred Tice reporting from Rochester, New Hampshire, right in the middle of an Elizabeth Warren event. Fred, thanks so much.
Great. You're very welcome.
So, listeners, we're inviting you to the conversation this hour. Continue to call in 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll do some analysis. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is a special hour of Radio Boston, broadcasting from downtown Manchester, New Hampshire. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I am Tiziana Deering, and we are broadcasting from downtown Manchester, New Hampshire today as the Granite State prepares to vote in the first-in-the-nation primary tomorrow. On the ballot, 11 Democrats and 2 Republicans, President Trump and challenger, former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld. We'll have some history and analysis for you in a few minutes, and we'll take more of your calls at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. But first, we bring you this report from Radio Boston's Zoe Mitchell.
It's Sunday service at the New Hope Baptist Church in Portsmouth. About 30 people are gathered to worship, most of them African American. The sermon is on Genesis 27 and the family feud between Jacob and Esau. Politics did not come up during the hour and a half long service. For Reverend Ryan Tankersley, religious and civic responsibility are connected, so he encourages everyone to vote. But
we don't direct people in which candidate to vote, but what we do is encourage people to vote, especially since this is Black History Month and the history of voter suppression. If you're of age to vote, you should vote. People have fought and died for our right to vote. So we encourage everyone to vote, but we do not say who you should be voting for.
20-year-old Terry Robinson of Dover takes that responsibility seriously.
Faith is a very big, strong point for me. But at the end of the day, it's also about the policies that you're going to enact and if those policies are just humanitarian.
Robinson told me one candidate had visited the church last weekend, former Mass Governor Deval Patrick. But most of the congregants seem undecided, like Waureen Vogel. She's 45 and also from Dover. She's drawn to candidates like Patrick and former Vice President Joe Biden and says it's about more than their policies.
I'm not too much for, like, the grand promises because they can't necessarily do a lot by themselves. They need Senate and the House as well. So it's more about character and integrity.
Ultimately, though, she says it will come down to a gut feeling on Tuesday. She's not the only one. Robinson says he's deciding between businessman Tom Steyer and Vice President Joe Biden. He's focused on what happens after the election.
After that initial, like, beating general election, how is he going to do for the next 4 years? With Biden, there's a sense of security of governance, and he knows what he's doing, the policies that he wants to enact, the economic policies that he wants to do, the foreign policy that he wants to do. He has that lined up. With Steyer, it's not so sure.
Parnell Fred Ross Jr. agrees. He's 82 and from South Carolina, but now he lives in Portsmouth.
All of them would do a good job if they got it. But I believe that experience should count, especially right now where we stand in the world, not necessarily here. I'm talking about Biden. He has experience. Biden can start working the first day.
Ultimately, though, he says he's ready for whatever the outcome.
Who knows what would happen? But ultimately, the charge won't be ours, it'll be God's. And we'll have to deal with whatever.
Boston producer Zoe Mitchell. We are broadcasting live from Manchester, New Hampshire today. And with me here is David Moore, a senior fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy at the University of New Hampshire. He's also the co-author with Andrew Smith of The First Primary, New Hampshire's Outsized Role in Presidential Nominations. Welcome, David.
Thank you.
Also with us is Chris Galdieri, who teaches government at St. Anselm College. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Chris, what's been the mood here in the last couple of weeks? Has it been different from previous primaries?
I think there's a lot of unease, uncertainty, indecision among Democrats. If you talk to Democrats, it sounds like they are very focused on beating Donald Trump. They believe that that is, you know, almost an existential question facing their party, and they're not sure who's the best person to do it. So it's this tremendous fear of making the wrong decision. I was at a Biden event last Tuesday, and everyone around me was saying they weren't sure who to vote for. They were still undecided. One person said they weren't just not sure who to vote for. They weren't quite sure which primary they were going to vote in. So you have a lot of folks who are just paralyzed at the idea of making the wrong choice.
So, David, that word paralysis is really quite striking. Do you think the Iowa debacle changed anything or heightened that going into tomorrow?
Well, with respect to the paralysis, no. But I think that Iowa did have a big impact on the standing of the candidates, particularly with respect to Buttigieg, you know, having done so well. He got a real real boost in the polls. And apparently the debate, at least according to two of the polls that were following the debate, showed that Amy Klobuchar got a big, surge. So with somewhere around 50% of the electorate still, of the Democrats, still uncertain as to which candidate they're finally going to choose, anything could happen in the next couple of days.
All right, let's take a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jeff's on the line from Newton Center, Massachusetts. Jeff, go ahead.
Hi. I'm a self-described political tourist, and I was in Manchester on Friday and back in New Hampshire yesterday on Sunday. And if you want to take activity at the headquarters as any indication of activity, it went from very busy at Buttigieg and Sanders to, I dare say, no activity at William Weld. His fifth floor walk-up when I went there was actually locked.
All right.
That's one observation. Klobuchar yesterday in Nashua had a massive crowd there, packed the gym, great energy, and it would lead you to believe, yes, she is coming on, as polls also have indicated. One thing.
All right, Jeff.
Go
ahead, Jeff. Do it quickly, please.
Yeah. One thing I would caution everybody, from pundits to the public, is that campaigns are very long. Because as I tell people, if that was the case, that it was in short bites, Herman Cain would have been president in 2012.
All right. Well, you got some chuckles from our panelists on that, Jeff. Let me turn back to you. Chris, how much is that presence of physical energy, lots of people around, an indication of who's likely to come out on top tomorrow?
I mean, I wouldn't discount that. I mean, when a candidate is having people turn out, that people are having a good time, they feel, you know, positive energy, psyched up coming out of the event, they tell that to their friends, they tell that to their neighbors, it probably, you know, makes them more likely to vote for the candidate. So I wouldn't say that having, you know, boisterous events means you're going to win, but I'd rather have boisterous events than very sparsely attended quiet ones where everyone is very sober and has a very thoughtful time.
Now, David, it's a large field. There are 11 people on the ballot. There was a large Republican field in 2016. Is this the new normal? Should we expect these kinds of large groups of candidates going forward now?
I think that's quite possible because of the ability of the candidates to wage their own campaigns on social media and to raise their own funds. So I do agree that the consequence is that the campaigns could be much longer. We usually think maybe two candidates come out of New Hampshire, maybe three, but usually two. I wouldn't be surprised to have as many as four candidates come out of New Hampshire this time and still be able to make their case as they go first into Nevada, then to South Carolina, and then to Super Tuesday. But I think Super Tuesday will probably be the real screener at that point.
Sounds like, though, you think there might be some culling after this primary as well.
Yes, I do.
Chris, do you agree with that?
I do. I think there are going to be some candidates who, based on their performance, are going to have to reach the conclusion that there's just not a path forward for them, and that the better part of valor is ending your campaign and letting the others duke it out.
Listeners, we're inviting you to join the conversation this hour at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm going to take a quick break in a second, but I'd like to grab at least one call first. We've got Casey on the line from Lowell, Massachusetts. Casey, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was up in Concord, New Hampshire last night attending a town hall with Tulsi Gabbard, and I have to say I'm really shocked and disappointed that there's been no mention of her name, no coverage of her campaign, particularly in this conversation, because there was a packed room there last night, and she went on to Concord to have another packed room. She's got a huge following, and because she's anti-establishment and she's been shut out by CNN and other major news publications, she's virtually silenced, which is really unfortunate because her message is...
Okay, Casey, I'm going to have to take it back from you there. Thanks so much. There's a voice for Tulsi Gabbard there. Stay with us. There's analysis coming up ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering, and this is a special hour of Radio Boston from Manchester, New Hampshire. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We are broadcasting live today from WBUR studio overlooking downtown Manchester, New Hampshire, as we prepare for the first in the nation primary here tomorrow. And we're taking your calls at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us now in our Manchester studio is David Moore, a senior fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy at the University of New Hampshire, and Chris Galdieri, who teaches government at St. Anselm College. Thanks to both of you for staying with us.
Happy to be here.
Also, we want to turn to Radio Boston's Walter Wuthman real quick. He spent the weekend here talking to voters, business owners, and campaign volunteers. Walt, who'd you come to talk to, and what did you hear?
So, Tiziana, as you've been hearing, you know, New Hampshire's status as the first in the nation primary is being increasingly challenged, especially by people who are arguing that it just doesn't make sense that this tiny rural state, you know, has such a say in picking presidents. It's 90% white, you know, and the country as a whole is 60% white. So I was curious about, you know, who is the other 10%? I met up with this morning with Suraj Budatoki. He is a refugee from Bhutan who came to New Hampshire in 2009, and he's now actually the constituent director for the Sanders campaign in New Hampshire. Obviously, he was really busy, but he said, you know, in a small state like New Hampshire, every vote in every community counts because it's just, you know, such a big impact.
How it works is a relationship, the time you spend with them, the story that you share, that matter.
So he's hoping Sanders does well here tomorrow, and then he wants to go to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and Columbus, Ohio, to keep turning out the vote.
Were you able to talk to anyone who was willing to engage on this question about New Hampshire's standing in this lineup specifically?
Yeah, I spoke to a couple organizers who did. There's Ava Castillo. She's originally from Venezuela, but she's been living in Manchester since the 1980s. She works for a Get Out the Vote organization called the Granite State Organizing Project. They focus on organizing immigrant and low-income communities here in New Hampshire. She says that she's actually met with every single Democratic candidate for president this cycle, except for Joe Biden. And she says that that gives organizations like hers a lot of influence because these people who might be the next president of the United States have to sit down, look into their eyes, and you know, hear about the issues that matter to them. Here's what she told me.
New Hampshire is such a beautiful place because you can make a difference. It's a small place, so your voice is heard. If I lived in L.A., you know, I'd be one voice among millions. And that's what we're trying here as an organization, to make people realize and understand that, yes, you speak with an accent, you might look different, whatever it is, you know, but you can really make a difference in this state.
And her colleague, Viola Katsim, agrees. She's from Uganda, but she says she's now 100% New Hampshire. And she says, you know, even though New Hampshire is a very white state, it's trending differently.
We have a growing population of the people of color population here. One of the schools in Manchester, which is Central High School, has several kids who speak, I don't know, more than 80 languages,
more than 80
different
languages in
right?
the school district.
And so this is the future of New Hampshire. This is the future of the country.
So these are voters telling you New Hampshire is still relevant. It belongs where it is in this primary lineup.
Yeah, which is interesting, right? So I also wanted to talk to just kind of a voter who's not organized with any campaign. So I stopped by Consuelo's Taqueria on Saturday. It's kind of a famous spot because it's near the arena here. It's the same arena that, you know, the president's going to be giving a speech at tonight. The owner, his name is Martin Delgadillo. He's from Mexico City, but he's been here in New Hampshire for about 20 years. And he says he wants a candidate. He wants something that goes beyond just policy.
I just want decency.
We don't have it, man. You know, I used to see United States as a very beautiful country in the sense of politics. What's happening now, it's a big change. It's a shock to the system.
So I asked him, you know, who might that be? He says he likes Joe Biden, but he worries he's too establishment. He says he likes Amy Klobuchar. He thinks Mayor Pete's really smart. And as we're going through this, Joe Biden walks by the taqueria outside. And Martin stops talking to me. He runs out from behind the grill. I try to follow him, you know, through the secret security and the press handlers. And I see them talking to each other. And then Martin comes back to me. And I ask him, you know, what just happened? What did you say to each other? And this is what he told me.
Yeah. You don't remember my name, that's amazing. He said, Martin, I forgot. No, you're too busy. I know he's busy.
Yeah.
Awesome. Anyway, guys, it's just fun.
Yeah, good.
It was kind of weird.
So, yeah, he remembered Martin's name from a previous visit. He apologized that he didn't get some tacos. And Tisan, in case you were wondering what retail politics looks like, that's it. And that's kind of what's unique about
that
this
state. That is amazing. That is Radio Boston's Walter Wuthman. Walt, thanks.
Thank you.
So let's turn back to our analysts, David Moore and Chris Galdieri. Let me just start with reactions from the two of you to what you just heard from immigrants who are very deeply active in this New Hampshire campaign. David.
Well, I was going to respond to the question of whether New Hampshire should still remain
well,
as first.
Yeah.
And I think that it's clear there's no logical or compelling reason why New Hampshire should be first. It got there because of history and because it continues to apply pressure on the Democratic National Committee to be first. But the real problem with those people who say, well, it shouldn't be first, is they can't come up with another state that should be first. You can try Florida, Michigan, South Carolina, but there are all sorts of objections. And the real problem is that both parties have not been able to find a consensus as to what should replace Iowa, New Hampshire, or Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, South Carolina as the
opening
states.
Which is the lineup
states.
As we go forward. Let's grab a call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. We've got Mike on the line from Hudson, New Hampshire. Mike, go ahead.
Okay, thanks. My question for the panel is, do you believe that the sheer number of candidates on the Democratic Party suggests a lack of solidarity and a lack of central focus in the mission? That's my question.
It's a great question for the panelists. Let's go let Chris pick that up. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it reflects a lack of solidarity, but it does seem that there's no longer a filter that keeps people from running for president. Once upon a time, people would sort of not quite run. They'd visit New Hampshire, they'd visit Iowa, they'd talk to some funders, and very often they'd decide, you know what, this isn't for me. Other people have done more legwork or are much further along in the process. This year, basically every Democrat who thought about running for president did for a while. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the effects of that huge field of candidates, I think at one point or another there were over 25 people running, is that it became really hard for the ones who weren't already very well known, Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, to break out from the pack. You had very talented politicians like Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, whose campaigns just never were able to get any traction, in part because they had trouble distinguishing themselves from all of the sort of, you know, backbench House members who decided that they were going to run, or, you know, the various New York mayors who have been involved in the race at one point or another. And I think that's something that both parties need to figure out. Like, do they want to keep going down this road? Is there anything that can be done to keep the field of candidates more manageable? If they don't, I could see the whole primary process kind of getting into a rocky place.
All right, well, go ahead, David.
Well, I think that there actually was some filtering out, not only because of the debates which filtered down, but also because some of the candidates didn't have the money. And I think that, you know, as you mentioned, Chris, the lack of money or the ability to raise money can really hurt a candidate as they go forward. And that helps to call out a lot of those candidates that aren't quite as viable.
Chris, go quickly.
Money absolutely matters, but the DNC requiring a number of donors to get on the debate stage led to really perverse incentives. So you had like Kirsten Gillibrand saying, donate $1 and we will give you a T-shirt. That's total waste of time for a campaign to be losing, you know, $19 per donor. But to get on the debate stage, they had to pull stunts like that.
And people perform to what's measured, right?
Exactly.
All right, let's grab a couple calls here. We've got Rama on the line from Gloucester, Massachusetts. Hey there, Rama, go ahead.
Hi, yeah, and I'm supporting Bernie as an independent and a Democratic progressive independent. Bernie's willing to do straight talk because just one quick point about some of the folks who worry if Bernie gets in, he'll be too left. He'll actually be fighting for the things that as Democrats they're supposed to be fighting for. So don't be afraid of that. Remember what happened. Trump was not a Republican. Trump was basically an independent wacko whatever, okay? All the Republicans, we've heard all the percentages, 94.7% of the Republicans are now supporting Trump. So the other previous call talked about solidarity. If Bernie wins, okay, he's actually willing to do straight talk. Now, a lot of the people didn't get behind Hillary a few years ago because they didn't trust her. Bernie's been consistent. Bernie's been truthful. Bernie's been is full of integrity.
Okay, I'm going to pick it up from you there, Rama.
Yeah, okay.
All right, thanks. Thanks for that call, Rama. So, you know, Rama saying, hey, people will get behind him and he will earn it. Let's take one more. We've got Seth from Waltham, Massachusetts.
I'm a liberal Democrat. I supported Bernie in 2016, and I've donated to Liz Warren earlier this campaign season. But as it gets closer to decision day, I'm starting to think that maybe what the country, not just the Democratic Party, needs is a candidate that can build consensus across the aisle. And I think you need look no further than the impeachment trial to see how tribal things have come. So I think we need to think bigger than
that,
just
Seth.
The party.
Yeah, thanks for that, Seth. And let me pick that up. David, so we've got Rama saying Bernie may be, you know, very left, but people will get with it if he is the nominee. And you have Seth saying, we got to have somebody who can cross across that middle. This is the existential question for the Democratic Party right now, is it not?
And nobody has the answer. There are people who say that Bernie can stimulate more people to turn out, increase the electorate. And then there are people who say, but as an avowed Democratic Socialist, he's going to turn off the so-called middle voters. So no one really knows whether it's better to go forward with a so-called centrist candidate or whether it's better to go forward with somebody like Bernie who can really inspire people to turn out.
So, Chris, what if it's the case that both of those things are true? Then what happens? Maybe a candidate like a Bernie Sanders does bring out lots of new voters but loses the middle in the process, mm-hmm. although Rama, I think, would take issue with that. What if that is true? Then what happens?
Well, then you don't want to nominate someone like Bernie Sanders. The problem is, if that's true, it might also be the opposite, that if you nominate a centrist, the Bernie Sanders people stay home. So, you know, there are an awful lot of Democrats trying to figure out how do you get these two groups together. And I think complicating that is that Sanders is an independent. Many of his supporters are people who not only don't identify as Democrats, but dislike the Democratic Party as an institution. They see it as sort of a convenient vehicle for a Sanders candidacy, not, you know, something that they have any particular interest in. So it's, you know, likely to be a close election in the fall, and this calculation is going to matter.
David, go ahead.
Well, I think that the eventual nominee will probably pick a vice presidential candidate that will try to incorporate the rest of the party into it. So we can't really just decide right now, should it be a centrist or should it be somebody like Bernie or Elizabeth Warren, because either one of those might choose to have another candidate who would help fill out the not only the demographic but the ideological composition of the party.
Okay, we've got about 30 seconds left for the two of you. David, what's the one thing you're looking for tomorrow?
I guess who wins.
All right, well, that seems pretty straightforward.
I guess I would look to see whether or not Amy Klobuchar and Elizabeth Warren are able to come in third and fourth and beat out Biden, because I do think that Biden is really probably on his last legs if he doesn't do well here.
And Chris?
Yeah, I'm not just looking at the order, but I'm looking at the spread. Is it a really close fight for first and second or second and third? And I think who's in those slots and how far away they are from their nearest rivals is going to tell us an awful lot.
All right, that's Chris Galdieri, who teaches government at St. Anselm College. Thank you.
Thank you.
And also David Moore, a senior fellow at the Carsey School of Public Policy at the University of New Hampshire. Thanks so much, David.
Thank you.
All right, and that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, and Paris Alston, with help by Wes Martin. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering today by Max Liebman and Renee Marchando. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering, live in Manchester, New Hampshire. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.